Our topic tonight is leading faithfully. We will be in 2 Samuel 5. Well, we'll talk about the whole chapter. Our focus will be on the first 12 verses. So let's share some thoughts and get our minds set for what we're going to talk about. The Lord always acts in the best interests of His children, Romans 8:28. He assigns roles and tasks to us, and He provides us all we need to fulfill our assignments. He expects us to faithfully discharge the responsibilities that He gives to us. Our study tonight is about the tribes of Israel anointing David as king over Israel and his subsequent capture of Jerusalem, which was then named the City of David. And the emphasis is going to be on acknowledging God's gifts and guidance in discharging our responsibilities. And the study will challenge us to remain faithful at all levels of responsibility. It's going to highlight for us important qualities about David's character, as we have done in recent weeks. David recognized that the power and skills he had were gifts from the Lord, and he used them to further the Lord's purposes. And in the process, he grew spiritually, and the Lord, in turn, entrusted him with greater responsibilities. And so it is with us. As we faithfully follow God, He gives us greater opportunities to grow through providing us greater ministry challenges and opportunities. So just to bring us up to where we are, briefly. After Saul's death, David and his family traveled to Hebron, where Judah's leaders anointed him as king over Judah. Abner, Saul's relative, was determined that Ish-bosheth, Saul's oldest surviving son, should continue the dynasty that Saul had begun. So Abner anoints Ish-bosheth king over the rest of Israel. That was in chapter 2. A bitter civil war ensued, as we've talked about. Gradually, David began to gain the upper hand, and ultimately Abner defected from Ish-bosheth to David and began to work to promote David among the other tribes. Joab, David's nephew and general, murdered Abner in an act of revenge. We looked at that recently. David distanced himself from any connection with Abner's death and mourned for Abner in chapter 3. News of Abner's death brought great concern to all of Israel. Two of Ish-bosheth's men murdered him. Then they took his head to David at Hebron, thinking that David might reward them. And you know what happened as a result of that. David decided to execute them. He wanted no one to think he had any part in Ish-bosheth's death. So now the stage was set for David to assume kingship over all of Israel. And that brings us to where we are today in chapter 5. And Fred, I believe you are going to read those verses for us.
Then all the tribes of Israel came to David at Hebron and spoke, saying, "Indeed, we are your bone and your flesh." Also in time past, when Saul was king over us, you were the one who led Israel out and brought them in. And the Lord said to you, "You shall shepherd my people, Israel, and be ruler over Israel." Therefore all the elders of Israel came to the king at Hebron, and King David made a covenant with them at Hebron before the Lord, and they anointed David king over Israel. David was 30 years old when he began his reign, and he reigned 40 years. In Hebron, he reigned over Judea 7 years and 6 months, and in Jerusalem he reigned 33 years over all Israel and Judah.
Okay, thank you.
Judea and Judah, the same word.
Pardon?
Are Judea and Judah the same word?
The word there is Judah.
Okay.
So I don't know.
I'm not sure
what Fred was reading. Do any of your translations say Judea?
No.
I think it's all Judah.
It's Judah.
Oh, that's okay. I just didn't.
Okay. Yeah. Verse 1. All the tribes of Israel come to David's Judean capital of Hebron to ask him to be their king. Now, this doesn't mean that every Israelite made the journey to Hebron, but the elders of the tribes came and represented the people. There are other parallels. We're told in 1 Chronicles chapter 12, verses 23 to 40, that the total number of soldiers and others represented is 340,800. They didn't all come to David at Hebron. 1 Chronicles 13:1 tells us that of the military leaders, there were some 3,750. And it may be that they came representing all the soldiers and all the people. And this way, everybody could participate through them. The Israelites listed three reasons for wanting David to be their king. First, he was their own flesh and blood. And though this phrase often describes people who are related by blood ties, but it also refers to people more indirectly related. So you remember David was married to Michal, Saul's daughter, and so was related through ties to Saul and his clan. But the Israelites here were thinking of a stronger tie. David, of course, could trace his lineage back through Jacob's sons to Abraham just as they could. So he was part of God's people and their family. He was one of them. Second, David proved himself in verse 2 to be an outstanding military leader, even during the time that Saul was king. You remember that shortly after David killed Goliath, the Israelites recognized and celebrated David's abilities as a soldier and general. That's back in 1 Samuel 17, verses 48 to 51. Remember, Saul has killed his thousands and David his tens of thousands. Okay. David's abilities during this time and his fame had increased while Saul's had decreased. And so the Israelites believed that David had accomplished more for them than Saul. Third, the Israelite leaders reminded David of God's words to him. God had decreed that David would shepherd Israel. He would be their ruler or leader. The prophecy quoted by the people isn't preserved here in this narrative, but God's choice of David as king of Israel is a constant theme. There are several verses you recall that mention that, and that Samuel's anointing of him, of course. In the ancient world, the profession of shepherd beautifully described the role that God intended for Israel's kings. As a shepherd cared for his flock's needs, so a king should care for his people by leading and defending them. In the Bible, shepherd also describes the future ruler that God would send, Ezekiel 34:23. So David would be an effective shepherd for Israel, but our Lord Jesus Christ would be the perfect shepherd. And you can reference John chapter 10, verses 1 through 18. God had brought David a long way. The man who cared for his father's sheep was poised to shepherd God's chosen people. With the flocks, David had exercised his God-given gifts of courage and leadership. During his days as a fugitive from Saul, he led and was responsible for some 600 men and their families. Many of you have walked through this time with me. When God opened up greater opportunities for leadership and service, David stood ready. In verse 3, as we come to that, there are three times that individuals or groups had anointed David. First, I mentioned Samuel had anointed him as the future king in 1 Samuel 16:13. David then began to hone his skills as a leader and to grow in his faith. When the men of Judah later anointed David as their king, here in 2 Samuel chapter 2, verse 4, he found himself responsible for an entire tribe. And again he employed his skills and matured in his faith. Now all the elders of Israel prepared to anoint David as king. So here he is now about to accept far more responsibility than he had had up to this point. God's guidance had prepared him, and God's presence would sustain him. Now here we're told that David made a compact or a covenant with the elders of Israel. The text doesn't give us the terms of whatever this agreement was, but probably David made promises that would benefit Israel, and the elders made promises to be loyal subjects to David. The union formed between Judah and Israel later on, we find, proved to be fragile, and there were ongoing tensions that remained between the two and finally led ultimately to the division of the nation. But I would point out at this point, sadly, that it didn't have to happen that way. Unfortunately, it did, but it didn't have to happen that way. Part of this whole ceremony of anointing included pouring oil on the anointed one's head, symbolizing that the person had been set apart for a specific task. So probably both the priests and the elders participated in this ceremony. And everything was done, we're told, before the Lord. indicating that the ceremony had both religious as well as political significance. See, the Israelites recognized God's activity in David's life and knew the time had come to affirm what God had already done. Verse 4 tells us that David was 30 years old when he became king. And people in the ancient world considered a 30-year-old person to be in the prime of life. I suppose we still kind of do. David already had experienced many triumphs, adventures, difficulties in his young life, but now he was physically and spiritually ready for more. And we're told that for 40 years David ruled. 40 years was the traditional length of a generation, Numbers 32:13 and Joshua 5:6. That span of time allowed a generation to serve and lead and then be replaced by the next generation.
Ron, I need to ask a question.
Sure.
Just for clarity, from a political standpoint, he went to Hebron and he ran for 7 years over Judah. So am I talking about two different districts there? Because I know that from you can see Hebron from the walls of Jerusalem. I mean, it's in the distance, but it's there.
Okay.
So the short proximity, just the logistics, why was he able to rule Judah from there as opposed to just ruling it from Jerusalem?
Well, he hadn't yet taken Jerusalem or selected a national capital. We're going to talk about that.
Okay. Right.
Yeah. We're coming to that. Actually, we'll get there starting in verse 6 in our next segment of verses. But here in verse 5, David's 40-year reign covers two periods. First, he reigns in Hebron for 7 years and 6 months as king of Judah. So it struck me, even after Ishbosheth's 2-year rule, there was still a time of healing and transition going on. A reminder to me that God has the right time for everything that he wants to do. After being anointed king of all Israel, he ruled over a united nation for 33 years, for a total of just over 40 years of service as king. And since he was 30 years old when he became king, he dies approximately at the age of 70 or so.
Sorry.
As with David, we often discover our abilities and develop capacities for larger tasks by doing smaller tasks. God then entrusts us with greater responsibilities. Throughout life, the Lord wants us to grow in our faith, not only for our own sakes, but so that he might use us to accomplish his purposes. Let's use our gifts for God and follow him as he offers us greater opportunities to be of service. And I would remind you also that whatever God calls us to do, he equips us to do, and he is never limited by our limitations. So here we are. This is our first discussion point. I would like for you to think about and share with us how doing well with small God-given responsibilities has led you to growth and expanded opportunities for service. How has doing well with small God-given responsibilities led to growth for you and expanded opportunities for service?
At church, where we worshiped before, I wanted to be involved. But I might have been a little rough around the edges. And the pastor there was just a full-blown alpha male. And he said, I want you to agree. And I thought, I'm running a big company right now. Surely there's something more than being a greeter I can do around here. There wasn't. I needed to be the greeter, and I did it for 3 years. And I did it joyfully. And I learned more about the people, more about the genuine circumstances, and more about what could be offered and the work that could be done from right there at that door saying hello and good morning.
So from that position,
yes.
Did you grow, and did God give you another opportunity for service as a result of your faithfulness there?
Remarkably. We ended up in the lead of the marriage ministry in that church. And knowing those people, you can't get out of the car and everybody put on a little plastic smile and come to the door. It doesn't work when you ask them how it's really going. Yeah. And so consequently, we get to know the people.
Yes.
And knowing that, God used that to be able to reach into people's lives, and the church got healthier.
And on a semi-related note, I just want to mention, because you talked about how, as you greet people and you say, "How are you?" Yeah. You know, they'll off, "I'm fine, everything's good," you know.
I had a
friend at the church in Mesa where Cliff was pastor, that when he would come up to you and say, "How are you?" And you'd say, "Fine." And the next words out of his mouth were, "Are you sure?" And
really?
it was yeah. done
yes.
with sincerity and a desire to really know. And, yes. and you know, he was able, because he was a sensitive listener, to read faces and body language and voice inflections and be able to tell that maybe, based on your response, it was something you might need to talk about or some way that he could offer some further encouragement.
It really was that, because I didn't have the heart when I started. But when I found working with people in their lives, my heart got huge, and I could be hurt.
Okay.
Because they got hurt.
Okay, so there was a growth taking place in your lives as well. In your life as well, okay. Yeah. All right, others?
I think the Bible classes here have made me a much stronger person. I go to 2 a week. I should go to 3, but I'm too lazy to get up early Wednesday morning.
You and me both.
No, I got my kids to get to school, but... And I think my presence here, I've only been here almost 3 years, but the fact that I go to the Bible study here opens my mind much more than it was. I thought I didn't know nothing until I started getting really into the Word and exploring and listening and learning. And that's been a wonderful experience for me.
Okay. Others who've been given opportunities that turn into... not only growth for you, but larger opportunities?
I think my whole life, you know, God was working from being a young person in a church through, and you can see how all the way along the way, what you learned was used for the next stage. You know, I didn't start off pastoring and having a staff and all of those kinds of things, you know, but when you are being a missionary and doing that kind of thing, we began with little things, you know. We taught Sunday school, we did other kinds of things. I was a youth pastor. All the kinds of different experiences. And then, you know, I had a seminary pastorate, then I had a full-time pastorate, and then I went from that one to, you know, it just seemed like larger responsibilities. But not that you're necessarily trying to get larger, but each one prepared you for the next thing. So, hey, Josh, come in.
Did I watch the movie?
So... you know, as you go along, I think God uses those. But if you're not faithful in the... if along the way you think this isn't, like you said, this isn't big enough, and you don't do it, I don't think you're ready to go to the next stage. I certainly wasn't... I never was prepared. I was a young pastor. When I started seminary, my first pastor, I was 22 years old. Well, I was teaching in the Church of Men's class with these guys my age and older, you know, and because they had a guy that stirred the class up, so Pastor, you have to teach it. 22-year-old teaching the older guys, you know.
That'd be tough.
And so, I mean, it just, I was over my head all the way through, but you just faithfully, you know, carried out the duties and learned, and along the way you hopefully don't make too many mistakes. God keeps using you.
Thankfully, when we do make mistakes, he keeps using us.
Yeah. So you learn from mistakes, too.
Yes. So. Sometimes painfully.
Oh, yeah.
All right. Anyone else?
I think teaching, even if you're starting with the younger kids, can open you to growth in a respect for the teachers and for the spiritual weight that's on their shoulders, but also for caring for the church body as a whole, specifically the kids. And if you jump even a couple grades, it's a completely different world teaching the same lesson to 5-year-olds versus 4th and 5th graders.
Okay.
And you really got to be observant to them and obviously sensitive to the Holy Spirit how to teach them. So there's growth within you and you care for these kids and it works its way up getting to adults. You learn the lessons you learn from Sunday school, teaching Sunday school, and you take those with you.
Yes.
And can I note,
yes,
I'm a little disconcerted that you're not wearing black today. What's going on with that?
New shirt.
Normal, he's messed us up, didn't he?
He did.
I knew something wasn't right. I couldn't pick
you
what
couldn't,
it was.
Couldn't think of what it was, yeah. Yeah, black is a favorite color, so, yeah. Okay.
Ron, before you go on,
yeah,
I'm going to ask you to go way back to the beginning of your talk. And the very first sentence that you came out with, which I was trying to write down, and of course you just kept loading on words and I never was able to. But you gave us the lesson for the day, which started with acknowledging God's gift. And would you give us that sentence again, and then it'll also help Josh know where we're going today.
Well, the title of our study was Living Faithfully. I'm not sure where it was that you wanted me to go back to.
There was a sentence that you said, what our lesson was going to be through this whole thing today was going to be acknowledging God's gifts and da-da-da-da-da-da.
I know. I hear a summary sentence for the day was, as we faithfully follow God, He gives us greater opportunities to grow through providing us greater ministry challenges and opportunities. Is that close to where you wanted? I'm not sure.
Okay.
I can go back to that whole...
As we look toward what you're going to be showing us about David in these chapters,
mm-hmm,
we're going to be looking at the gifts God gave him and how he grew in that.
We're going to be talking about that here the rest of this hour, actually.
Right. Okay.
Yeah.
But then you're going to keep applying it to us. Okay. So
yeah.
Is it really just about acknowledging God's gifts and then how we grow through that, or how he's faithful to supply our need?
All of that.
Thank you.
Yes.
There we are, Josh.
2 Samuel chapter 5.
There.
All right. Let's pick up verses 6 through 12.
Now the king and his men went to Jerusalem against the Jebusites, the inhabitants of the land. And they said to David, "You shall not come in here, but the blind and the lame shall turn you away," thinking, "David cannot enter here." Nevertheless, David captured the stronghold of Zion, that is the city of David. And David said on that day, "Whoever would strike the Jebusites, let him reach the lame and the blind, who are hated by David's soul, through the water tunnel. Therefore they say, the blind or the lame shall not come into the house." So David lived in the stronghold and called it the city of David. And David built all around from Milo or Milo?
Milo.
Milo, thank you. Land in the middle on me there. Milo and inward. And David became greater and greater, for the Lord of hosts was with him. Then Hiram, king of Tyre, sent messengers to David with cedar trees and carpenters and stonemasons. And they built a house for David. And David realized that the Lord had established him as the king over Israel, and that he had exalted his kingdom for the sake of his people.
Okay. Yeah, there's a lot more in this narrative than meets the eye. Okay. Verse 6. So the king and his men marched now. He's the united king of Judah and Israel, and he's looking for a location for his capital city. Jerusalem offers a perfect choice, since it lay between Judah in the south and the influential Israelite tribe of Ephraim in the north. And the city, if you know anything about its geography, I thought about doing a sidetrack here. I decided ultimately not to. But you can go online, and if you look up David captures Jerusalem. Like if you Google that, you'll and then do images, you'll come up with a slew of pictures and maps of conceptions of what that looked like. Some archaeologically and some pictorially. But it gives you a better feel for what we're talking about when we see how David and his army actually attacked and took the city and difficulties that were involved in that and why Jerusalem would have been such a helpful place to have as a capital. So the city did enjoy certain natural defenses on three sides, surrounded by valleys on three sides. So David marches with his private army to take the city. Now, little is known about the Jebusites. They may have been a Canaanite clan or a small ethnic group not related to the Canaanites, and although their identity is uncertain, they constantly appear in the list of inhabitants of Canaan that Israel would defeat. For example, Exodus 23:23, Deuteronomy 7:1-2, Joshua 24:11. You know, you remember all those, the Canaanites, the Hittites, the Jebusites, blah, 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 blah. So they're always on that list. So as David surrounds the city, the Jebusites taunt him. Okay. They believe, what? Something?
I was trying to figure out what he was. What
yeah, I'm getting there. Okay. As he surrounds the city, they believe that the city was so impregnable that even the blind and the lame could repel David's army. Now, to modern ears, this is not politically correct, okay? A taunt like this sounds especially degrading since it disparages the worth and abilities of those who are physically challenged in some way. But this taunt accurately reflects the Jebusites' arrogance and their overconfidence and their contempt for others. The inhabitants of Jerusalem would soon find out that they were not as invincible as they thought. Verse 7, despite their confidence, David captured the fortress or the stronghold of Zion. Now, interestingly, this is the first time Zion is mentioned in the Bible. The Canaanite named Zion referred to a fortified hill in southeastern Jerusalem that rose between the Kidron and Tyropian valleys. The meaning of the word is uncertain. Some Bible students suggest the meaning of a dry place or a mountainous ridge. But with the passage of time, this is fascinating to me, with the passage of time, Zion came to refer to the city of God in the coming age. And you can reference Isaiah 28:16, Isaiah 33:5. So not only the city of God in the coming age, but also the heavenly Jerusalem. Hebrews 12:22 and Revelation 14:1. That's important to note this as you study, that Zion came to refer to the city of God in the coming age and the heavenly Jerusalem. Thus, you think of the classic hymn, "We're marching to Zion, beautiful, beautiful Zion. We're marching
to Zion.
The beautiful city of God." That's where that whole thing comes from. So having captured the fortified hill of Zion, David renames it the city of David, and rightfully so. Since he captured Jerusalem using his personal troops, the city now belonged to him and could bear his name. So the emerging nation now possesses an excellent site for a capital, and David possesses an inheritance for himself and for his descendants.
So at Zion, he's saying not just that stronghold, but all of Jerusalem, all of that area.
Well, Zion came to, it was originally just this particular section of Jerusalem, but it came.
Do you know where in Jerusalem it was?
Well, there's a fortified. You'd have to look at it on a map, on a specific map of Jerusalem at that time, to see where it's located. But again, if you'll do that, do a little bit of searching, you'll be able to see that, and they'll show you where it is.
The city now is four stories deep, five stories deep, yeah, from all of the, you know, walls falling in. But I just wondered if it was an identifiable place now.
The city of David itself covered, we're going to talk about that a little bit more, but it covered about 12 acres. So yes, it is an identifiable place.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. 12 acres, that's a pretty big.
Yeah, it's a nice swath for a fortress. Yeah. Okay.
I have a map here you can look at later if you want.
Okay. Yeah, I chose for time's sake not to digress too far into the geography of Jerusalem. Otherwise, we would have been here a while. But there's always good stuff that I have to decide what to put in and leave out. And so, okay. Verse 8. Rather than employ force to take Jerusalem, David used a bit of cunning. He told his men that the water shaft provided the best means to conquer the city. In 1867, a man named Sir Charles Warren discovered a 48-foot tunnel cut through the rock that connected the upper fortifications to the Spring of Gion. The tunnel enabled the inhabitants to have constant access to water during a siege. Some Bible students believe David captured Jerusalem by sending men to climb up the tunnel into the city and catch the inhabitants by surprise. You see that in movies sometimes. You see, you know, Joab and the crew crawling through the tunnel to get into the city. Others think that David simply cut off the water supply to the city and forced the Jebusites to surrender. 1 Chronicles 11, chapter 11, verse 6, reveals to us that David offered to promote the soldier who led this attack to his commander-in-chief. And it was Joab who led the attack and earned the position. We have this mention again of the lame and the blind and are specified as David's enemies. So here David uses the Jebusites' own mocking terms to describe them. We're not sure what that proverb there means, but the best explanation, I think, is the idea that the surviving Jebusites were prohibited from entering David's palace from that time forward. As we know, later David invites Jonathan's lame son, Mephibosheth, to eat at his table with David's son. So David didn't exclude the lame from his palace, but David excluded the arrogant, insensitive Jebusites from his palace. And once he captured Jerusalem, he dismantled their government and established his own. So former officials in Jerusalem had no access to the palace or the government of the new king. That's what I think that proverb means. In verse 9, since David moved into the fortress, he took up his residence there. His capture of Jerusalem didn't apparently destroy the fortifications. Another indication of a battle won by cunning rather than by force. And then David quickly moves to build up what you called the Millo, which the NIV describes as supporting terraces, which is a good description of it. This section of land was huge. From what I've read, it was like some 1,500 feet by 900 feet. And the King James translates it Millo, which is, it's a transliteration. It's, you know, comes to English that way, but literally it means the filling. What David did is he expands the city by bringing in dirt and rocks to provide more level surfaces on which buildings could be constructed. And when you look at the images of this, it becomes very clear. There's huge swaths of terraced pieces of land that go up the side of this hill upon which structures could be built. It's really fascinating archaeologically. And they've dug a lot of this out and stuff, and that tunnel and to the spring of Gion and all that. Yeah, so yeah, it is kind of fascinating. So, let's see. This Millo, David expanded, and then later on Solomon will continue this and expand his father's project, we're told in 1 Kings 9:15 and 24 and then 11:27. And also actually a little later on there's a reference to Hezekiah also reinforcing and restructuring some of that. Some in verse 10 who observed David's growing power might think to credit his success to his leadership ability and military skills. We're told he became more and more powerful. And while David did possess those kinds of gifts, his increasing power and influence came from God. Here referred to as God Almighty in the NIV, which is an alternate translation of the term you may have God of Hosts or Lord of Hosts, a name for God that's associated with the Ark of the Covenant. The ark represented God's powerful presence with his people, and God clearly was present with David, leading and blessing his people. As we live out our Christian faith, we need to remember God's empowering presence with us. Many people have a hard time resisting the notion that they alone are responsible for their successes. But the Bible warns us against becoming proud or arrogant because of our accomplishments, Deuteronomy 8, 10 through 14. We have nothing that we didn't receive as a gift from God, 1 Corinthians 4, 7. And we need to thank the Lord for the gifts he has generously and graciously given to us and use them fully for advancing his kingdom purposes. God often uses people to bless others, and he wants to do that with us. And he wants his blessings on our lives to spill over into the lives of others. In verse 11, as David grows more and more powerful, so did the nation. One of the neighbors, Hiram, king of Tyre, which was an important Phoenician city, recognized David's growing power and influence and moved quickly to make a treaty with him. And I would refer you to your map just to glance and see where the location of Tyre was. You'll see it there in the southern part of what's labeled Phoenicia in pink. So you can see the general proximity of what's going on there. And there's even a reference to Tyre on your hand, and to Hiram on your handout. So as part of this treaty, Hiram sends messengers and cedar logs and carpenters and stonemasons to David to build a palace for him. The durability of cedar logs made them ideal for pillars, roofing, and paneling. And since Israel had little experience in constructing large buildings, the skilled craftsmen that Hiram sent provided the expertise that they needed. So I think it's an interesting thing here that David received and got help from his neighbor. And it's something to think about at this point. How open are you to accepting help from others when you're carrying out your God-given responsibilities? A small note, but an important one, as we talked at the outset about the teamwork. And it's as I was looking at this, it struck me that in churches, God is team building. Paul uses the analogy of a body and all the parts working together for the growth of the body. But, you know, in modern terms, we might say God is team building. He's putting the right people in the right places. And so certainly as we and as leaders, as pastors, as you are moving in your area of responsibility, you can't do it without accepting help from others and carrying out those responsibilities. We need each other. There's no expendable people in God's church. Everybody has a role. Everybody has a part. And all of us are important. Both Phoenicia and Israel profited from this treaty. Phoenicia needed the agricultural products that Israel produced and, as a trading nation, needed safe access to trade routes passing through Israel. And Israel benefited from both the trade passing through the nation and exposure to the skills of the Phoenicians. So for the first time now, Israel has become a welcome and equal partner on the international scene. And it's interesting that David and Hiram remain friends, and Hiram later assists Solomon in the building of the temple, 1 Kings chapter 5, verses 1 through 12. And he assisted David, by the way, in partially in all the preparation for some of the building materials for the temple.
I need to ask you, We can safely say God orchestrated that. I'm okay with that. But if somebody else had taken that over, they were still going to need a way to pass caravans through there. So if it hadn't been David, they were going to make amends with somebody, whoever was in power in that land.
I would assume so. If you've got warlords there, then I'm sure they've got if you want to get through somebody's territory, you
seem like the right thing to do.
Okay. In verse 12, as David reflects now on what God has done, two things become obvious to him. First, he knew that the Lord had established him as king over Israel. He readily acknowledged God's hand at work in his life, and he knew that more than his own skill had brought him military successes and national and even international influence. He was aware of his true source of blessings. It, pause for just a moment and think about what God has been preparing you to do. Maybe you can look back at your life's earlier experiences and see how God's hand has been at work in your life. And think about what lessons you've learned. How have you grown through those experiences? Life's smaller trials, challenges, and opportunities often prepare us for bigger trials, challenges, and opportunities. And as God sets a new challenge before you, recognize that any power or skill you have is a gift from His hand. How can you use that power or skill to accomplish His purposes? God is able to do far beyond anything we can imagine if we'll choose to yield our gifts to His will and purposes. So first, David knew that the Lord had established him as king over Israel. And second, he knew that God had brought him to power, not for his own sake, but for the sake of his people Israel. Earlier, you recall, he had cared for his father's flock, ensuring that no harm came to the flock, that the sheep had ample food, water, and rest. On his way to becoming the shepherd of Israel, David faced difficult circumstances, but through God's guidance and power, had survived and triumphed. So now, having become shepherd of God's people, he assumes the responsibility of protecting and nurturing that flock as well. Israel didn't exist to enrich David. David ruled to bless Israel and provided spiritual leadership as well as military leadership. Something that Saul completely failed to do, by the way.
Well, Saul was weaker.
Okay. Soon, David's going to face a Philistine threat against his people. And this is in verses 17 through 25. And he immediately turns to God, relying on God's power and guidance to defeat Israel's enemy. David placed himself and his God-given gifts at God's disposal to serve God's purposes rather than his own selfish interests. And as he let God lead and he followed him faithfully, God gave him greater and greater responsibilities. Depending on our time, I may come back and talk a little more about verses 17 to 25. So we'll see how that goes. Right now, what I would like to talk about are the things that hinder us from recognizing our God-given gifts and using them for His redemptive purposes. So think with me, brainstorm with me, what things hinder us from recognizing our God-given gifts and using them for His redemptive purposes?
Fear.
Okay, good. We maybe lack the confidence. That goes along with fear, I suppose. Yeah. That, you know, how can God use me, or what? I'm not really ready for this. But did mention before, whatever God calls us to, He equips us for. And I'm not sure we're ever going to be fully ready. When we enter a larger area of responsibility, there's always a little bit of an element of faith and trust in the Lord that's got to come through. You don't want to be able to just do it in your own strength, and you want to be in a place where you know you have to depend on God entirely.
You know, what's really interesting is, as we go through our daily life, day after day, week after week, and say everything getting smooth, and all of a sudden something happens. Maybe you lose a job. That's when you really find out. Do you trust in the Lord? He says, tells us all the time, knock and the door will be open, seek me, and now your faith becomes shaken. So the faith is a very, very touchy, fragile thing. I have faith, and if they're going to put a gun to my head and say, are you going to deny Christ, or are you going to die, what would your faith do then?
Even today, as I was studying myself, I was reminded of the fact from Romans that even our faith, although we need to exercise it, is a gift from God, that He nourishes and strengthens and holds and keeps it. So should we be faced with that situation, It's my faith that the Lord will give me what I need in that hour. He will give me the grace and the strength I need to stand true. He will give me the faith that I need.
Well, hasn't you said, what you said earlier, you said that God isn't curtailed by our weaknesses?
Our limitations.
Our limitations.
Yeah.
That's really as much as I need to know that. My limitations are great, so I don't...
As are all of our limitations. Reminds me, of course, of Paul's statement, which I wrote extensively about. My grace is sufficient for you. My strength is made perfect in
through
weakness.
It's got a huge palette here to work
on. True of all of us, my friend. True of all of us.
Yeah, I don't like when I'm tested.
So our focus here is now, we're talking about the things that hinder us. What else hinders us from recognizing the gifts that God has given us and using them for His purposes?
Our flesh.
Okay, in what way?
Well, I would say that, first I would say it as, you know, our flesh. And then in which way? Every way. You know, temptation, it just across the board. All of our flesh.
Thinking in terms of our weaknesses?
Or
limitations, as we're just discussing, or a different way?
Our flesh limits God's
presence.
God's, His presence or His workings. You know, was that... Did I misunderstand the question?
No, you have it right. That's what you're saying, and you're saying flesh, our flesh, and by that, thinking that you mean we're distracted by many things. It's much easier to just get involved in our culture and try to live along like everybody else is doing.
Spiritual side and, you know, your soul, your spiritual side that yearns to be with God and loves that connection that you feel and get from Him and stuff. But then you have the other side. It's like,
yes.
I'd rather sit here, watch TV.
And so sometimes we're living, walking more in the flesh.
So another way to say that is if it would definitely be a hindrance if we're living and walking in the flesh instead of walking, being led by the Holy Spirit. That's definitely going to hinder your recognizing God's gifts.
Most of us walk in both those places.
Everybody
all the time.
We're back and forth.
I can't give you a day that I walked in the Spirit all 12 hours that I was up. It just doesn't happen.
Okay.
Distractions too.
Maybe.
Good. Okay.
Ron, yeah. Ron, maybe you live in the Spirit all the time. We don't.
No. No, but we can.
Yes.
That's,
I understand that.
So, I mean, not perfectly, to be sure, but consistently, I believe, we can. But it does have to be a matter of intention and focus.
Right. But it is, like John said, it's the flesh. That's
a hindrance.
I agree with you that you can, but I think that most people and most Christians don't. And it's, most of the time it takes, until they're getting ready to get out of this world and even... connect all the dots to really realize what it was all important.
Or a real
That's
traumatic.
That's a good point. My faith is much more realized and much more understood at my age now than it was at your age.
Because it's faster and I feel my strength and my youth and all the fleshy things. You know what I mean? That distract me from the spiritual things, which are last forever, more important.
Maybe that's why the church are filled with gray hairs.
Okay. All right.
That's so, demographic down here,
buddy.
So we're talking about the things that hinder us from recognizing our God-given gifts and using them for His purposes. Let me suggest one, just for example. Maybe it'll spur some other thought. Sometimes we could be reluctant to use our gifts because we think they're unimportant or unnecessary. That would be a hindrance. There's a lot of Christians who think, my gift, I look at somebody like Pastor Cliff and I compare it, what do I have to offer?
A lot.
So, How can God use me? I'm not really, I don't matter. My gift's not significant enough. It's unimportant. So that could definitely be a hindrance if you thought that this is why we so urgently emphasize the fact, or Paul did, I should say, not us, that God has put every member in the body for a reason and a purpose, and that all members of the body are important to the growth and edification of the entire body. All right?
Yeah, I think you're right on. And I think sometimes the reason is that people just refuse to take an opportunity. They're asked, or they say, hey, here's something. And it's amazing how many people don't see a need. And the need is almost a call sometimes. You don't have the gift, you can do it, but you see and you step in and you say, well, I don't know if I have it, but somebody helps me or can give me some stuff, I'll give it a try. And as you try to do some of these things, then these gifts in you grow and develop, or you don't even know you have them until you're put in those circumstances.
Okay.
I see far too many, having tried to get people to do things who will not try to do anything and are content to sit there and not do anything. And it's just amazing. As you look at the number of people in a church that have just gone all the way through and really not done that much. And then it's a sad waste of gifts, I think.
The things that I'm called to do, I would defy you to stop me.
Oh yeah,
I can't not do them.
Well, you're at enough. Not do them. You're at another level, but I mean, in the beginning.
No, I don't think so.
Well, the fact is, the statistics haven't changed over the years. There's at least in Southern Baptist circles, 20% of the people do 80% of the work. That's been true forever, and I don't see any reason to see that's changed at all.
That's a business. It is a standard. 20% of people make all money.
Yeah, and there's a lot of reasons that people will not step out or step up like that. Yeah. There's all kinds of reasons, personality-driven sort of reasons.
Well, this is sort of what we're talking about here. But yeah. another one is that going along with what we're talking about is people are unaware of the gifts they have, and this is one reason why when we do a new members class here, we focus and highlight on learning and discovering what your spiritual gifts are. We find that people, did not know or realize that they were gifted in a certain area. Okay? Right. Let me mention a couple of others. We mentioned, Fred talked about fear, and I mentioned a lack of confidence, or some people would seek to use a gift for themselves instead of I think that's Jeremy outside.
Maybe he's getting straight.
People were seeking to use the gift for themselves. I remember a long time ago listening to James Robison when he was still being an evangelist, and he had talked in a sermon about how, I forget if it was J. Paul Getty or some billionaire who had offered him an enormous amount of money to use his gift for the businessman's ends, and he absolutely refused. He says,
so
this is
a person could choose to make all kinds of money being a motivational speaker instead of getting into the spirit and working within the church to teach or to preach.
If you were called by God to use your gift as James Robison was, mm-hmm. for his glory and purposes,
right.
then to turn around and use it for personal profit, and we have no shortage of so-called evangelists or Christian leaders today who are using their gifts for personal profit, who've become multimillionaires. I am critical of that. I am. If you think that God's got you in that so you can be a multimillionaire, you've got a problem, a serious problem. If that's your motivation. Let's see. Some others. There's sometimes it's an unwillingness to prepare ourselves. We know what God wants or what he's given us, but we're not willing to prepare. Sometimes, as we've talked about in our whole study today, we're not willing to stay faithful in the small tasks. And so we never have an enlarged opportunities for the greater ones. And now, as I was thinking about this, I also brought to mind something that, you know, all pastors, different pastors have their issues that they highlight. And Pastor Cliff used to highlight the concept of fat Christians. And if we had more time, I'd let him elaborate a little more. FAT and being an acronym for faithful, available, and teachable. And that was something he would always emphasize to his flock, that that was important in the in your spiritual growth and the nurture of your gift. You need to be faithful, you need to be available, you need to be teachable. And if you are, then you can expect that God will help you grow and will use you for his purposes. Okay. Any thoughts, comments on anything we've talked about today? Anything you want to add?
I think when we exist in a small fellowship, smaller than we are even, small churches, people are more inclined to step up and do, answer the need, instead of waiting for a tap on the shoulder from God. You know, they see that this needs to be done in the fellowship, or this needs to be done. As the church body grows, I see people pulling back and saying, I did my share. And let somebody else step up for a while.
Oh, I guess a soapbox issue there for me. This has to do with retirees and some of our more senior members who have that kind of a mentality. I've done my bit for God and country. I'm out. I'm going to let the younger generation take over. I don't read anywhere in the Word where God lets you retire from his service.
Ever.
While you're, you know, as long as you are capable, and if you're not, if you're capable of praying, you can serve, and there's always some way to serve. And if there's not, the Lord knows that. But to sit back and say, now I'm X number of years old now, I'm not going to serve in the body anymore, I just don't believe that that is a scriptural teaching.
We do also have situations where women have historically handled a certain area of ministry, so men don't feel that they have any call to step in.
There's no different thing where else, they've abdicated their roles across a culture.
Yeah. And in a situation like our growing church and the growing number of young families and teachers that are, or children that are coming in, we are in need of volunteers for things that, and you can't go to our 70 plus people for volunteers for taking care of little children because we physically can't do it. We can do other things with them, you know, the older kids, but not with the little kids. And so,
well, sure.
Men have to step in too.
Yeah. It's not, you know, there's just, appropriate areas of usefulness, right, depending on, you know, your age and your,
right,
capabilities.
And it took a while before we had men in the church that we're stepping into some of those roles, men who are now teaching in the Team Kid program.
Okay.
And but it took a while for them to realize that, hey, here we go, I can do this. There's a need.
This is my soapbox, and this is one reason I like the our slogan, you know, first family. You can't be a family in these gigantic churches. It's just absolutely impossible. And many people go to those gigantic churches just to say,
to get lost. Yep.
Just
the anonymity
is
its very best.
And they can sit there and they can be there and they can say hi and they can go. And to me, unless, you know, if I were pastoring one of those, my basic thing would be to try to get people to use their gifts and not just come and sit. I mean, but a lot of them, it's just the mentality. The more we fill up the building, you know, the better success we have. You know, we have so many, we have 10 Christmas Eve services, and I've got friends that are going to one, and they watch the pastor on a screen all the time, and he's in 3D, so they don't know if he's there or not. So this is our part of our world, but the church was never meant for to be a gigantic observation of the show. We need to get in, and I think a lot of the people in some of the big churches are actually doing something. We're trained in churches like ours, and you know, yeah. had chances and opportunities.
Bigger doesn't mean help.
No, it isn't. And I remember one guy who wrote a book about all these super churches. He says about the only they do two things a little bit better. Sometimes worship, and then there was one other thing. But discipling and a lot of the other things that are going on that ought to be a part of a church, they fail miserably at many of the areas. And we've come to think, you know, bigger is better, when really I think the church is a family. And you know, you think about that when you get sick. Does somebody even know my name? Would don't know I wasn't there?
Right. Well, we have a pastor for that.
Yeah.
We have a specialist
and
for
that's
that.
Exactly how a lot of people were raised in churches that way. So, and they haven't gone, they haven't thought beyond that, you know.
I wanted to share with you a, we won't, because we won't be covering it. There's a verse in this
fine. Don't stop,
that's okay.
I just got to stand up.
The last couple of verses of chapter 5. And in David had twice fought off the Philistines here, and God gave him great victories, and ultimately God will give him a good deal more. But in this second battle that takes place in verses 22 to 25, there's this fascinating segment where the Philistines come up and spread out in this valley of Rephaim. So David inquires of the Lord, which we find him doing over and over again here. And the Lord answers, "Don't go straight up, but circle around behind them and attack them in front of the poplar trees. As soon as you hear the sound of marching in the tops of the poplar trees, move quickly, because that will mean that the Lord has gone out in front of you to strike the Philistine army." So David did as the Lord commanded, and he struck down the Philistines all the way from Gibeon to Gezer. That whole thing about the marching in the tops of the poplar trees, what's that all about?
We don't, a movie in there somewhere.
We don't know exactly. I mean, was it the sound of the wind? Is it the sound of angels? Is it just a sign from the Lord that he's moved out ahead of the army and is going to do his work? But whatever it is... they saw the sign, and then they went forward, and the Lord went before them, and they won a great victory.
What kind of seeds grow on poplar trees? I started visualizing those little helicopter seeds.
Oh, yeah.
No, I think poplars are just leaves, and I don't know that they have
Actually, my text uses mulberry trees instead of poplar trees.
Too.
Is it mulberry? Right.
Yeah. The Philistines slipped on the berries on the ground.
Balsam.
Yours is balsam?
Here's where you tell the bushes moved, and that was a...
But, you know, it had to have been a supernatural
Yes, that's the highlight there, yeah.
It had to have been, you know.
That there is something supernatural going on. I think something supernatural going on there.
Yeah, I think so.
So, okay.
We've got to cut it.
Yeah, we're done. Yeah, we're done. Thank you. Yeah, you bet.
Thanks, John.
Only interesting fact I know is that...
John, you're in there or you're out by now, I promise.
David was the 10th generation from whatever pastor that was born. I don't know if you recall that. It's like some Jewish law or something. Like if you have a bastard son, he can't rejoin the people of Israel until the 10th generation. And David was the 10th of that.
Well, doesn't ring a bell.
So I mean, it couldn't have been Saul because